you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Up next, the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we are still in the Taurus realm, where we are reminded to think of soil, the surface, and the underworld. So today's show is The Soil Will Save Us, which is the title of the book, The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet, by our wonderful guest, Kristen Olson, whom I will be bringing in a few moments. Let me weave a little context first. So we are loving disharmony back into harmony. That comes from previous wonderful guest, Michael Gruber. To love disharmony back into harmony creates a greater harmony than existed before. And we go, oh, let's do that. We are here, of course, dedicated to Kristen's wonderful book, The Soil Will Save Us, that we may heal our partnership with the soil's living, guiding ingenuity. And by doing so, by embracing a long-term vision, assuming cultural narrative lead, especially important in these crazy muggle politics times, we animate great projects which then become stories that inspire other people to do great things that then become stories, and that's how it all travels. Again, Kristen's website is kristinolson.com. That's Kristen, K-R-I-S-T-I-N-O-H. LSON.com. As you know, we are in Fund Drive. It is a perfect time to do that. We are offering two pertinent, wonderful things because we are a cauldron of cultural renaissance. May it be so. We'll be offering Kristen Olson's wonderful book, The Soil Will Save Us, as a thank you gift for a pledge of $130 or more. We are offering last week's guest, Bill Benenson's DVD, Dirt, the movie, which is really good and completely pertinently related to all that we're crafting and all that so many wonderful allies and guests, and we should put on our own conference. Bill Benenson last week on Dirt, David Bloom on how we can turn everything into alcohol. There is no such thing as, there need not be such thing as agricultural waste. Paul Stamets's longtime dedication to the, you know, the fungi, mushrooms will save the world. Stephen Buhner's fabulous work on how we should better treat invasive plant species, Janine Benyus, a wonderful work on biomimicry, and Ellen LeConte, and joining this fabulous team is Kristen Olson. So before we dive in, you can have The Soil Will Save Us for a pledge of $130 or more. You can have the fabulous DVD of Dirt, the movie, for a pledge of $75 or more. You can have both for a combo of $200. There, you're saving $5. There you go. Both for $200 by calling 510-848-5732, 510-848-5732, or 800-439-5732. And to all of those listening on web and podcast, because we have a pretty fabulous global audience, you can go to kpfa.org and we go, hello, Australia. You were covered in this book. Hello, South Africa. You were covered in this book. You know, hello, Japan. Hello, Alaska. Hello, Midwest. Hello, England, and all our many wonderful listeners around the world. There we have it. So welcome. Kristen, granddaughter of farmers and the daughter of avid gardeners, Olson has long had an appreciation for the soil. A chance conversation with a chef led her to the crossroads of science, farming, food, and environmentalism. She discovered there a vast kingdom I'm always in favor of sucking the G out of kingdom. A vast kingdom of creatures under our feet, billions of microorganisms in a tablespoon of soil that take the carbon dioxide that plants pull from the atmosphere and turning it into life-giving soil carbon. Olson introduces us to visionary scientists, farmers, foodies, ranchers, landscapers, whose work shows that the earth can be healed and offers the hope that apparently intractable problems like global heating, climate change, air, water pollution, food quality, and even obesity have the same low-tech solution, and also dead zones. Yes, so many dead zones. So welcome, Kristen.
Hi. Thanks for having me on again.
It is a great pleasure. And yes, I have your splendid book, and I can, with complete enthusiasm, go, this is a book to put in all libraries. This is a book to savor. This is very readable. It is beautifully readable. It's got raves from Bill McKibben and all of our team. It is an invaluable, you know, part of our reference library, as well as a narrative that takes you right along into a hope realm. You know, from last week's show, we were the narration of Dirt the Movie says we live, you know, it's the only known planet that has a living, breathing skin called dirt. And then he brings in many, many people, the likes of yourself, to honor this. But and I guess the week before, John Rulak on ocean acidification drove Earth's largest mass extinction. 252 million years ago, that killed most life on Earth, and now we are causing that. There are many places we want to go, but you mentioned towards the end of the book that, you know, the American Farm Bureau, and I mean, these are people who are still skeptical about human-caused climate change. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about that and how it might be shifting?
I think that, the Farm Bureau has been an organization, and they are very, you know, until I started working on this book, I thought that the Farm Bureau was like farmers, you know, and I like farmers. But the Farm Bureau is an organization that's very much tied to all the big, agricultural interests, and, they have had the position that, global warming, global heating is, you know, it might be something that's happening, but it is, in their view, not happening because of human activity. But I think that the way that I like looking at this subject, this stuff, is that even if an organization like that, and even if individual farmers share that view that human activity isn't causing warming, everything that I write about in the book about healthy soil, about partnering with soil, is good for farmers. It's good for their land. It makes their land more resilient. It makes their land hold moisture. It makes their streams clearer. It makes their crops better. In many cases, it makes them more money. So you can be a complete climate denier yet still embrace the promise that healthy soil offers.
Beautiful. No, that's true. It's like last week we referenced wonderful youth leaders in environmental healing from all over the place. And one of them was head of, you know, kind of Christian evangelical, you know, kind of right-wing group. And they were like, yes, we're going to get raptured, but meanwhile, we must restore Eden. And it's like, yes, you know, we can have arguments later. Let's go to this. Let's, you know, the partnering that you mentioned, I mean, all stories guide us to all stories, and your book, The Soil Will Save Us, I think really guides us to everything important in the world. How can humans, you know, it's sort of like human murderous sociopathic ignorance versus life's ingenuity. Oh, okay, but you're feeling, you know, we can do this.
Well, I am, and I think a lot of it has to do with a growing understanding that when we stand on Earth, you know, when we stand on soil, that we're not just standing on this inert dead stuff. We're not standing on a dead rock that has this tiny little covering of green growing things. We're standing on top of an ecosystem that's very vigorous and very diverse, an ecosystem that was there before, you know, anything was going on above the earth. Those soil microorganisms have been there for billions of years, and they have been in partnership with plants ever since plants moved on to land, which was about half a billion years ago. And everything that we see above the soil line was produced by that partnership between plants and soil microorganisms. So I think that once we humans understand that sort of component, that until now hidden component of our ecosystem, that we can start to behave in more creative and responsible ways. You know, even now when you go on the internet and look for diagrams of ecosystem, you know, there are those drawings out there where it's, you know, it shows everything in an ecosystem. It shows, you know, it shows little grasses and little insects and then bigger plants and, you know, flowers and then trees and larger mammals and larger insects and birds and all that. But most of those drawings, most of those representations completely omit that life that's going on under the soil. And it's a terrible omission, because without that life under the soil, none of that stuff that exists above the soil would be there.
No, I love that, because you are about, you know, you concentrate, and we want to delve even more deeply into the dark about loving the dark. You have a great chapter on seeing the invisible world of microorganisms, and then Heroes of the Underground is another of your later great chapters. So, you know, it is an interesting, you know, to heal what is before us is to heal, in a sense, everything. But humans have been, you know, averse to the dark, like, oh, dirty. Or I also love previous guest whose book was on healing the human-insect relationship. I'm like, oh, there's a good idea. And she goes, we kill what we don't know. Ignorance is a great, you know, incentive to inadvertent violence. Again, everything collaborative. When we were talking with David Bloom, I guess 3 weeks ago, he said, you know, feed your enemies and host your allies. So everywhere he's got wonderful little toad spas in his huge 1 acre greenhouses, you know, and the toads come and they eat the insects and it's all good and they use no pesticides. So we are full of ingenuity. But I want to toss back to you that we can dive into the dark, you know. Well, there's so many places I want to go. But we do want to dive into the dark, but maybe we want to dive into the ancient dark sea of purple. I was thrilled to find out about this in chapter two. The ancient seas would have been purple. You do a great history, the archaea, the ancient ones, living deep in the ocean near volcanic vents. Can we just pick up on their narrative a little bit and
I can't tell you that much about their narrative because, you know, people, they still exist, but people don't, you know, people are, there's a lot of ancient histories that sort of have either disappeared or are too hard to follow up on. But, you know, that of course, most of us understand that life as we know it has come from very, very, very tiny life forms. And most of us, you know, think of plants as the things that brought oxygen to the world, you know, brought oxygen to the world in the percentage that we thrive under it. But it was actually cyanobacteria that first began photosynthesis and tossing off oxygen as a byproduct of their work. And it's plants have carried that on, but without those cyanobacteria that oxidized the earth, you know, nearly 3 billion years ago, we would not be breathing today.
And no, I love that. Yes, the first photosynthesizers, single celled purple bacteria, and you say the ancient seas may well have been purple.
Right.
But I love just to bring in another radio guest, one of my favorites, Rick Gallo, who is a deep, 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 deep ocean scientist. And after the beginning of the Gulf ecocide had him on, and you know, he had many difficult things to say. But like yourself, he said, you know, the bottoms of the ocean are more fertile even than the Amazon. There's waterfalls and incredible diversity. And yes, humans have really mucked even here up. But he said, at the bottom of the sea, there are these vents that are constantly blowing new life into our world, you know, biogenesis, like, and he said, so, yes, we humans have caused great harm, but life is creating more life at an incredible rate, and that's something to hold. So the archaea, they live deep in the ocean near volcanic vents, so they were extremophiles is what we call them now, right?
Mm-hmm. And here's an interesting thing. Those archaea, they live in extreme environments, including in human beings.
Ooh.
You know, one of the things that I'd love to make this analogy, you know, that there's all this, it's fairly new information, this all this that we're starting to understand about these life forms that exist in the soil, you know, billions of them in a teaspoon of soil. And I think it's very much like the kind of new understanding that we have of the human microbiome. So there's the Earth's microbiome that is partially in the soil, you know, that soil microbiome that I write about in the book a lot. But it's you know, that understanding is so comparable to what we're learning about the human microbiome. You know, there are trillions of microorganisms that live in and on people. And that's pretty new knowledge. You know, we didn't really understand that until what, 10 years ago, 6 years ago? You know, it's pretty new information. But now, you know, scientists and physicians realize that human microbiome, those trillions of microorganisms that live in us, are responsible for so many critical functions, you know, for our immunity, our immune system, and our metabolism, and even the way our brain functions, that's how important that is. And, you know, and physicians really treat people quite differently now than they did before they had that knowledge of not wanting to do things that killed off that microbiome. And I think we're starting to get to that point with soil, where people are understanding that we have those heroes of the underground, that we have these allies, these potential allies in soil, and that we have to start being much more careful, not only not to kill them by our activities and deny them food by our activities, but we have to partner with them as much as possible.
Well, I'm completely in favor of your optimism, and maybe you even taking the lead, going, you know, many doctors are taking into consideration the complex community that comprises us, and I go, oh, I hope that's true. I'm rooting for it, Kristen, because of the absurd overuse of antibiotics, you know, on rare occasions when it's useful. I go, sorry, civilization, goodbye. Oh, got to rebuild you with, you know, sauerkraut and probiotics and build it all back up. But, yeah, and then now we go to one of the big, important, huge, forever themes of your book, The Soil Will Heal Us, which is the invisible, which is the dark, which is the underworld, that we as a media modern species have made the underworld mythologically like, but it wasn't always that way. It wasn't hell. It was soil. It was richness. It was plant medicine that took us to the initiatory realms. In the one of the earliest stories of Pluto and Persephone, the Pluto figure is not a guy. It's plants. It's Pharmacia is his name. Pharmacia takes us into the underworld. And it was considered a good thing, not a bad thing. So, you know, I love that you're, you know, and even just in kind with right now, the little people in fairy tales, the little people. Well, there are little people, these bacteria. And also, do you know about tardigrades?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, do you want to just give tardigrades a moment on the radio?
Oh, no, I don't know that much about them.
Okay, well, let me just bring them in a little bit. People can, just again, what an amazing planet we live on. So tardigrades, I was first told about this by Rupert Sheldrake's sons, Cosmo and Merlin, who can, you know, almost live up to their names. And I thought they were kidding. But if any of us listening Google or YouTube is where you want to see them, tardigrade, T-A-R-D-Y, G-R-A-D-E. They are microscopic little beings. They're their own kingdom, really. They are incredibly, I find them cute. They're like six-legged teddy bears, microscopic. Everywhere, wherever there is moss or water, and when there is not, the reason NASA's studying them, when there's not water, they can go into suspended animation for decades. NASA took them into space, waved them out the window, basically, and they were fine when they got back, no problem. So they're the substructure of reality is tiny, really cute, and incredibly resilient. And again, they're everywhere, and hardly anybody knows about them. So anyway, tardigrades off to one side. Now back to bacteria. Loving the dark. So many ways that you're addressing this. Do you want to just bring in the heroes of the underworld so that we can learn to honor what we can't see and then begin to see that, I guess, through microscopes and so on in the 17th century.
Heroes of the Underground.
Heroes of the Underground, yeah.
Yeah, I had wanted to call my book that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought it would be... I was afraid that The Soil Will Save Us, that that wouldn't appeal to enough people as a title, so I thought of Heroes of the Underground, but my editor was not crazy about that idea. But that's, I mean, that's sort of the... the conclusion that I came to after working on this book and after being so struck by the amount of optimism that I was finding among these people who are working working on soil health. And, you know, some of them have come to that through food, you know, from being concerned about the quality of food the way food comes to us, either the way it affects food justice and wages, or the way it affects landscapes. And people have certainly come to that place of soil health from farming, where people are struggling to make a living through through the toolkit of conventional industrial agriculture.
You mentioned Peter Grofman studying soil and water in Baltimore. Baltimore's got its moment of long moment of attention. And again, you honor that, you know, everywhere is life. And there is a switch now. I don't know if you, to switch to asphalt that is permeable in cities like Los Angeles. That would seem a sensible step. Portland, where you live, you say has built swales along the streets, yeah?
Yeah, I see swales going in. I mean, unfortunately, I think that there are a lot of best practices, and I just saw that there was a conference at, I believe it was Harvard, to talk about some best practices for managing soil in cities. And I really wish I had been able to go to that. But I think that there are best practices that are starting to accumulate in cities around the country, and I wish that they were much more widely known.
Right. Well, that's our job. That's the job of your book and this show and Dirt the Movie and everything. Yeah, which is because it is one of the Heroes of the Underground. You might have gotten a lot of left wingers buying your book, which they should. But there is a gathering, and you're certainly part of this, and having a clearly informed understanding of but a jaunty attitude, and that. So in Los Angeles, I mean, there are so many teammates doing ingenious things. We do want more people to know, and just as an effortless pitch, it is part of the value of Pacifica and KPFA and the Visionary Activist Show, so that we can spiral essential cultural information out into the world, so that we all have it in accord. And just a brief little side, our wonderful guest is Kristen Olson. Her great book, The Soil Will Save Us, can be yours as a thank you gift for pledging $130. And we're also offering Dirt the Movie, which is fabulous, and they really work well together. Last week's guest, Bill Benenson, for a pledge of $75, or both of them for a pledge of $200 by calling 510-848-5732. Or 800-439-5732, or all you podcast, webcast people out there, kpfa.org, also good. And now back to our programming. So it's, well, the swales, Although you say there's too much gravel in Portland, in yards. But, you know, we go, until now, just stop that, all you people with gravel in your yards.
And still too much Roundup. I still see
really?
Too much Roundup being used on the roads and in the public gardens.
Oh.
Even
in Portland. Oh, my God. Too much Roundup. Yes, it is. It is prevalent. Until now, let's say that in my cute little Maryland, we've been discovered, but funky little neighborhood, it used to be that every house sold was torn down and then Monster Box went up and people would come in with lawn services and crime lights and toxic Roundup and whatever. But then after about 3 weeks, they would stop. It's like the land was still and the river was still strong enough atmospherically to calm down, everybody calm down. You're not at war with nature. There you go, there you go, there you go. But I'm particularly fond of swales, just because years ago somebody said to me when I was saying, let's slow down to speed up, and they said, all of your metaphors are our facts. The more you slow water down with swales, the more you slow it down, the faster it infiltrates.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that as a social strategy idea. The more we slow down right now, the faster we infiltrate.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, so even...
Let me get back to what you were asking before about Heroes of the Underground, because
yes.
I think, you know, one of the things, I was just reading something about climate change, and, you know, I think one of the things I really like to point out is that... we are so, the climate movement has been so focused on emissions, only on stopping emissions. That's been pretty much the single strategy, is pushing back against the energy industry, pushing back against, our cultural overuse of fossil fuels. And that is, I think that we have to really realize how much that's a limiting strategy. Because if we stopped all fossil fuel emissions right now, you know, just magically could stop them all right now, the climate would still continue to warm for 30 years based on what's already up there. So we need, in addition to that strategy of stopping emissions or at least slowing them down, we also need a strategy of how to reduce that load of greenhouse gases that's already in our atmosphere. And I think that's where that Heroes of the Underground thing really comes into play, because I think that so many people, and I don't know if this has to do with the amount of climate denying climate change denying that there is, but I think it certainly must affect the amount of climate change apathy, because if you realize if your sole strategy is stopping emissions and you look all around you and you see that emissions are clearly not stopping, then, you know, it gets pretty dispiriting to feel, you know, it's pretty dispiriting. You don't feel like you can do or that anybody is doing anything to get a grip on the problem. But I think that, and that's where this stuff about the soil really, I think, comes into play so much, because healthy soil, you know, plants removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through photosynthesis, plants make a carbon fuel from that carbon that they remove from the air. They share up to 40%, sometimes more, of that carbon fuel with those microorganisms in the soil. And those microorganisms in the soil take that carbon and do a number of things with it. But that is the most winning, the most positive strategy for getting that carbon dioxide out of the air. So unless we do that part, you know, we're kind of cooked. So that's why I think this book is so important. I mean, I would love to see, the kind of war footing that we've all read about, you know, during World War II, you know, victory gardens and everything sort of being focused around supporting the war effort. I would really love to see that kind of emphasis going on around the country, on farms, on ranches, in city parks, in backyards, on how do we make soil healthy, and how do we help plants work with, how do we help plants thrive and work with soil microorganisms so that they can do that vital job of removing carbon dioxide from the air, and that those soil microorganisms can do their vital job of putting it in the soil where it's healthy, where it's a sign of health.
No, that is so important. Again, it is all about cooperation versus dominance. Because a theme that runs through the soil will save us, your wonderful book, is a good soil practice, as you just said, I'm just repeating it, can reverse global warming. 3 billion tons of carbon can be sequestered annually in the world's soils. Rebuilding globally, because you went all over the world, there's Nigeria and there's Australia and there's talking about long-term vision. But you also, just to go backwards a smidge, bring up a really good point. If we're just focused on emissions, that's where, if we're harumphy, we're not really effective. And one of the things that makes me harumphitudinous is in my invaded, cute little neighborhood, there are humongous SUVs, and they pull up in front of the post office or the cafe, and they leave the motor running while they go in, and it just, which does not make me effective either. And sometimes I leave notes. And sometimes, if I'm jolly, they'll turn it off. I even got a policeman. I go, it is the custom here to turn off our motors. And he's like, oh, all right. But sometimes and it's true, that's not going to resolve things. Much better, to go, did you know, again, 3 billion tons of carbon can be sequestered annually in the world's soils, rebuilding globally everywhere, and especially because of drought. It is the building of the soil, and we're going to take a very short little song break here just for station identification, the cool of the day, just a beautiful little song, just a smidge. And we'll be right back with our guest, Kristen Olson, to dive into everything, the importance of animals and everything that we can cover in 10 minutes. And here we go.
My Lord, he said unto me, do you like my garden so fair? Well, you may live in this garden if you keep my grasses green, and I'll return in the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Oh, this earth is a garden, the garden of my Lord, and he walks in his garden in the cool of the day. Then my Lord, she said unto me, do you like my garden so pure? Well, you may live in this garden if you keep my waters clean, and I'll return in the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day. Now is the cool of the day.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our splendid guest today is Kristen Olson, whose book, The Soil Will Save Us, is vaster than we can even touch on in this precious time together, which is why you will want a copy. Yes, you really, really will. And to give one to kids and to libraries. Kristen's wonderful publisher and herself are making available so that we can have this as a thank you gift for a pledge of $130. Thank you gift is The Soil Will Save Us. It works really well with last week's guest, Bill Benenson, co-director of the movie Dirt, the movie. We're offering that DVD, which is also really, really useful. These things work so well together. The Soil Will Save Us. You can have Bill Benenson's movie Dirt, DVD, Dirt the Movie, for a pledge of $75. You can have both. Really a good idea for $200. They work so well. We are cauldrons of cultural renaissance. We want to know. The more we know, the more effective we are as change artists going, did you know about this? And this book, The Soil Will Save Us, is full of things you can go, did you know? So by calling 510-848-5732, That's 510-848-5732 or 800-439-5732 or securely online, kpfa.org. So, yes, in our precious time together, but we can think of this as part one or part two, Kristen, because your book is very, very rich. So much, and I also just want to stress to our dynamic listening audience that it is really a delight to read. You've really written conversationally, beautifully. You're conveying complex things in a really simple and charming way. I love Anton von Leeuwenhoek, the first to see and describe bacteria in the 17th century. And I guess his charmingness, I then most always saw with great wonder that in said matter there were many very little living animalcules, very prettily a-moving, he says. It's so charming. Prettily a-moving. There we go. And tooth scum he was impressed by. But so we have heroes of the underground. Let us honor and love the dark. That would improve all of life. Going, there we go. And just because we can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But then you also have a great chapter on sending in the animals and the cows. And maybe we want to honor that when herds were moving, they helped to heal the land.
Yes, I mean, if you think of the great prairies in the great American prairies, you know, that soil is some of the healthiest soil in the world. Those were not just created by plants, you know, those were created by plants and their interaction with grazing herbivores, you know, these great, great herds of buffalo. And evidence that those grasses and those animals co-evolved, and that's why those soils are so beautiful and deep and rich. There are many ways that humans started to change our atmosphere, change our world when we started agriculture. You know, we started to burn down forests, we started to open up land, we started to create monocultures, you know, that came farther along, but you know, just planting the one thing that we wanted to eat and getting rid of the other things that we didn't want to eat. And one of the ways that we changed the environment was the domestication of animals, that we changed the behavior of those ancient herds so that they weren't moving over the lands and eating and sort of stimulating the plants as they ate enough but not too much, and leaving their dung and leaving their urine and, you know, poking holes in the soil where water could gather. That was the beneficial effect that they had. And when we changed that, either through herders or fences, we changed the beneficial action of those herds on the land. So it was a South African biologist named Alan Savory who first started to understand that cattle on the land is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it can be a very good thing as long as they are handled so that they move over the land the way ancient herds did, so that they keep moving. Ancient herds clustered together, you know, they didn't spread out all over the place, because if they spread out all over the place, they were offering themselves up as prey for some very strong predators. So they clustered together, they kept moving because they wanted to keep moving onto fresher grass. They didn't want to eat on top of each other, you know, from where each other had dropped dung and urine. And anyway, that constant movement where the plants were eaten but not eaten down to the ground, that was actually healthy for the environment. So anyway, he was the first person to suggest, or one of the first people to suggest, that we could actually heal land by moving animals over land differently. And that's something that thousands of ranchers around the country have, around the world, have been putting into practice on their own farms. In fact, the farmer the farmer that I highlight in the middle of my book, whose name is Gabe Brown, and he's in North Dakota, he has made many, many, many changes to the way he handles his crops and the way he handles his animals, and has pretty much, he's really transformed. He started out as a conventional farmer. He went to ag school. He did everything he was taught in ag school. He plowed. He sprayed chemicals. He confined his animals. And he began to change because that playbook was not serving him. That set of instructions was not serving him. His land was not resilient enough to stand up to these really big weather challenges that were taking place and that scientists tell us we're going to see more of. So he lost crops 4 years in a row to, you know, things like hail or frost or drought. And he really started to change his practices to build up the health of the soil. And now he's really a model. I mean, not just for, I mean, he certainly was a model in my book, but he, you know, thousands of farmers come and visit him every year to see what he's doing on his land. He no longer plows. He no longer uses chemicals. He no longer confines his animals. He has them rotating over the land. In fact, when he's finished harvesting a crop, those animals come through and chew it down. He doesn't use a machine to, you know, get rid of that crop residue. And as a result, his land is just, it's hugely productive, it's hugely healthy, it's hugely diverse, just not just the plant material, but the birds that come and the insects that are there. So it's really a model, and I also believe that it's a good model to put out there because he is more profitable than his neighbors who follow the same practices that he repudiated and left 12 years ago. He's very successful. So I think it's important to know that we can change our farming so that it's healthier and so that it heals landscapes, but farmers will still make a living. Farmers will make an even better living and make better food for us.
No, that is so crucial. And it's a big, interesting mystery, because I know that PBS, in their Earth Alive series, did annoyingly narrated, but still an interesting one on animals and migration, and just as you say and delineate in your book, before herds, then we move to no predators and imprisoned, and they eat plants down to the roots. But it was intriguing, you know, just it's a big thing that I'm opening up, and we can chew on it and like cows for a long time later and come back to. But you know, that the predator-prey relationship on this planet has been one of the great engines of evolution. Now, we also want to add altruism into it. But and that's why you said we don't need fewer, the narrator, we don't need fewer animals, but that we want them moving as though there was a predator, right? I mean, that the predator would, as you mentioned, keep them bundled, but also keep them moving. So apparently, maybe we can evolve so that it's less scary, predator, but just something that keeps them moving. It's a big, intriguing thing. And I guess we also want to prevent great harm, too. You mentioned in your time in Zimbabwe, you know, sending in the cows, you know, but people who wanted to kill the tsetse fly conveyor of illness were like, well, let's just kill all the animals. And it's like, oh, no. So preventing harm. But I love
one of the things that is so was so intriguing to me about Gabe Brown's farm, again, is that he's very careful to keep a lot of plant diversity on his property. So even when he's growing a field of corn, he has cover crops between the rows that are many, many different varieties of things growing there, just to, again, be always providing those soil microorganisms underground with a steady source of a carbon fuel. That's because that's what they eat. That's their food. Oh, gosh. I lost my train of thought.
Oh, that can easily happen.
Oh, no, I know.
Okay, there you go.
I was going to say that one interesting byproduct, and it wasn't one he anticipated, was that having all those different cover crops mixed in with his market crops means that there's always something flowering there. There's always something blooming long before the corn or the wheat or these other crops do. There's always something flowering there, and it attracts these hordes of insects. And one thing that he discovered, and then insect scientists have been going there to study what's going on, one thing that he discovered is that because there's all this diverse plant material growing on his farm, attracting this big, full, robust community of insects, that it's also, one of the things that it's doing is that it's attracting predator insects, which are killing the pest insects that, you know, his neighbors are spraying for. But on his farm, it's these predator insects that are relieving the pressure that he, you know, farmers ordinarily face from pests that want to eat their crops.
No, it's very beautiful. Oh, sorry, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a beautiful example of how that predator-prey relationship, you know, it's there for a purpose. It really works.
And over again, can humans just humbly, because we got our word human from humus and humble, humbly cooperate with nature's guiding ingenuity? The cover crops, that's why, again, David Bloom says, you know, feed your enemies, host your allies. Right, and Stephen Buhner says the intelligence of trees, if they're being munched on by, you know, a predator insect, they'll put up with it for a time, but when it crosses a border, the trees then send out pheromones that attract the predator of that insect. And it's like, oh, that's so clever. Meanwhile, like an internet, they send out pheromones to alert other trees in the community going, greedy guy's coming, make your pheromones now. There you go. So, you know, may we be humbled by the beauty and nature of cooperating. What you say is, you know, carbon stored as humus confers benefits and buffers against both drought and flood, and maybe that's where we will reluctantly leave so I can be responsible pitcher for show, but this is so powerful, you know, with the whole West Coast really, and so many parts of the planet, and certainly California in great drought, and that's why, you know, everything to treat all of this as precious. But can you say more maybe about the humus, you know, buffers us against, and the cover crops and all, against both drought and flood? Yeah.
Well, when I was talking before about plants making a carbon fuel through photosynthesis and passing 40% or more down through their roots to feed these soil microorganisms, so there's a trading that goes on there. The soil microorganisms bring plants nutrients that they've gotten from rock and, you know, sand and silt, and the plants are feeding those soil microorganisms their food, which is the carbon. One of the things that those soil microorganisms are doing with that carbon is that they make a kind of carbon glue. And with that carbon glue, they make habitat in the soil. So they're making tiny little pockets out of pieces of sand and maybe a little piece of a leaf. They're just making, so healthy soil that has that healthy population of soil microorganisms is kind of like a coral reef. It's not like a rock. It's not like, you know, this tight place. It's a place that has many, 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 many millions and trillions of pockets where air and water can be stored. So that, when you have soil that's like that, so when I was with Gabe Brown out in his field and he was sort of taking me around, and he had this 4-foot-long metal rod, which he was using as a pointer, just looking at different things. And at one point he bent over and he shoved that 4-foot-long metal rod directly into the soil, all the way down to his knuckles. And I thought, oh boy, but he must be a really strong guy. Let me see how far I can push it in. I could also push it down 4 feet straight.
Ooh.
So that speaks to how healthy his soil is, how much of that coral reef structure is in his soil. So that means when it rains on his farm, you know, it, when you have land that where the soil is not that healthy, what happens? The soil is compacted. There's no, there are no, none of those pockets for that, for the rain to flow into. So it tends to run off. It tends to run downhill. It runs into a stream. You know, you've seen streams that just look like chocolate milk after a, after a rainstorm. Well, that is rain that should be soaking into the soil. On his farm, it soaks into the soil. So that's what, that's what healthy soil can do during drought. You know, during a drought, it's not like there's never rain. It's not, it's, you know, there's not enough. There's not as much as there was. And sometimes it comes at odd times. But there is occasional rain. So when you have soil that's healthy like that, it's going to suck up that, that water like a sponge. That water is not going to run off. So it's, it's like an insurance policy. And same way in flood, you know, if the land is able to absorb, you know, he was able to stick that rod down 4 feet. So you could think of that as being like a 4 foot sponge there. If the land can absorb water that much and that quickly, it puts an awful lot less pressure on the streams and the things, the other areas that are going to be flooded. So that's, that's why having that healthy soil is just essential. It's an essential insurance against flood and drought.
That's very beautiful and true. I'm going to reluctantly release you, oh wonderful contributor to greater good and all things that we need. Kristen Olson, whose wonderful book, The Soil Will Save Us, is one of our thank you gifts for pledging to this station. But that's great, and let us continue conversing, and there's many things backstage and on stage I want to alert you to. Many John Rulak's conference, Soil Not Oil, and also many other festivals coming up, which we turn them into productive realms with the likes of Kristen Olson presenting, so that we can all know this. But thank you so much, Kristen.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That's great. And again, Kristen Olson, that's Olson with an H-O-H-L-S-O-N, because you are from Sweden? Where are you from?
Oh, somebody way back where.
Somebody way back there. Okay, very good. All right, wonderful. Thank you so much. Let us continue conversing. Thank you, Kristen.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's great. So, yes, that was wonderful. I couldn't let her go because we are offering her book, The Soil Will Save Us, by Kristen Olson, for a pledge of $130 or more. And that combines really well with Dirt, the movie by Bill Benenson, co-director, for a pledge of $75 or more, or for both of them, book and DVD for $200. Really a great, I got to say, this is an artful combining. You will know so much, and there's some repetition, but not a lot. It's more like that beautiful thing when two circles come together and there's a little bit of overlap, but they are great partners and companions. You know, what we know from last week, you know, is the prison garden projects, you know, jail to garden metaphor, you know, turn everything, no waste, no runoff, keep everything, treasure everything, and that means, you know, plants, creatures, animals, people, consider nothing as waste. But anyway, so for The Soil Will Save Us by Kristen Olson, pledge of $130, the movie, Dirt the Movie, DVD for $75, you can, or both for $200, you can call 510-848-5732 or 800-439-5732. So throughout the history of this show, coming up 19 years, many fantastic listeners say they often listen while they're gardening or while they're painting or when, sometimes on the road. All those things are great. But remember, we are here, all of us, cahooting together because we want to direct our own and cultural attention on what's really important and not what distracts us. There's a good thing on ScienceGasm on Facebook. You know, what we should know about why bats are dying by the millions, and what news tells us is, you know, Justin Bieber, you know. I mean, you get the gist of it. We don't need to tediously go through that. You know, we want to know about the issues of our time, and that is certainly what Pacifica and KPFA and absolutely this show, the Visionary Activist Show, is dedicated to. So also just to bring the metaphysics into the dynamic, because that's what we brew, to be pragmatic mystics is important. I so love, you know, when Pacifica was founded on April 15th, 1949, Sun-Venus conjunction, Venus was in the underworld, North Node, but the image for those degrees is, you know, a woman bursting with gifts more than she can hold, and that's really the spirit of Pacifica herself, a kind of living, vital, humans are all befoibled, coming and going wherever we are, whatever we're doing, but there is a vital dedication to democracy, to knowledge, to culture that is, you know, embedded at the very core belief. Saturn right now is right on top of Pacifica's moon, just for the fun of it, meaning this dedication to expanding and amplifying the listening, the dynamic, participatory audience. What we have here as a living treasure is an audience that does things. They go, permaculture, they implement things, they go lecture, they meet up, you know, so this is such a great marketplace, Zocalo, you know, caravanserai where we convene every week. So to support this show, letting everybody know we like the show. We love matches. We do love matches. You can have The Soil Will Save Us by Kristen Olson for a pledge of $130. You can have DVD, the DVD of Dirt the Movie by co-directed by Bill Benenson, last week's fabulous guest, for a pledge of $75, or both. Really good, for a pledge of $200 by calling 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. Yes, just thinking of Neptune, microorganisms, we can space out. But we put that over to one side. By timing, let's imagine again the flourishing of, you know, this network, this station, this show as an agent for our cahooting as we head in. It is indeed time everywhere for sane, reverent people to assume cultural narrative lead. So we're not just distracted by conniption fits and like, by what's terrible going, this is terrible and here's what we can do. Did you know about this? So it is human sociopathic ignorance versus nature's life's creative ingenuity. And everywhere it's the same story. You know, again, can we have true equality between men and women and Venus and Mars within us all and humans and the rest of life on this planet? If so, we ladle it out. And if not, we throw it back into Pluto's underworld cauldron of compost. We compost the undesirable and we are here to love the dark, you know, the dark that has been exiled. We go, no, it is the dark that will also save us, rich humus, underworld, things that we can't see. Everything that is a fact is also a social strategy, metaphor. You know, in an article years ago, Science New York Times, where most metaphysics can come from, and it was like scientists discover that beneath and around every river is an invisible river teeming with microorganisms, just like The Soil Will Save Us. Kristen Olson goes into in great, fabulous detail the entire history from when the oceans were full of the bacteria that was purple. There was purple seas, and then slowly plants emerging from the ocean. Plants start in the sea, and then once they form a partnership with the mycorrhizomes, the root beings, roots, you know, then they become stable. Then we can get shrubs and trees, and the entire history, we want to know the incredible thing, and then humans come and kind of rip up the thing and remove mountaintop stuff. Until now, we are part of the until now spring, until now culture. We go, but we go, this is metaphysics 101, that around everything, every river, every everything is an invisible, you know, river teeming with organisms. And what the scientist said is the health of the visible depends on the health of the invisible. Again, metaphysics 101. Well, that's part of the wonderfulness of radio. We're invisible. So we get to talk about invisible things and give them their voice. It is, you know, radio is so intrinsically democratic. I mean, TV has its place, but it's very different. You know, wonderful people usually get slimed on TV. But in radio, it's intrinsically intimate. Like, hi, how are you? There we go. We're all meeting as collaborative equals, all in council. So, again, you can have The Soil Will Save Us by Kristen Olson. Wonderful book, truly. Authentic enthusing here. For a pledge of $130, you can have Dirt the Movie. Also wonderful. I liked it even more. Second time viewing, really useful. But also as a resource, I need to reread The Soil Will Save Us many times. And also re-see the movie, Dirt the Movie, many times, because there's such rich teammates there. We want to know all of this to be effective, you know, agents of change in this world at this time of dire beauty. So again, the book, The Soil Will Save Us by Kristen Olson for a pledge of $130. Dirt, the movie DVD for a pledge of $75. Both of those, the book and the DVD, for a pledge of $200 by calling 510-848-5732 or 800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. I'm Caroline Casey. Follow me on Twitter, Stand Up Coyote, or anything else, coyotenetworknews.com. Thanks always to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley and Alex Grewinskis in Washington, D.C., with elves helping him right now today. And we will reconvene next week. Thank you, team. Woof. Oh, yeah,